You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Author of numerous books on empire and globalization, an emeritus professor of sociology, James Petras also is a journalist and activist, and he joins me from his home in New York. Good morning, Jim, and welcome to Vancouver Cooperative Radio.
Good morning, Marty. It's good to hear from you.
Let's stay with the U.S. elite for a moment. Two prominent American establishment academics recently wrote a critique of the role of the pro-Israel lobby, and admittedly, they had to go to England and the prestigious London Review of Books to get it published. Still, it's achieved one of its objectives of opening up this subject in the United States as well. I'm referring to Mearsheimer and Wald. I wonder if you could tell us what their approach to this subject of the pro-Israeli lobby is.
Well, I think they've done a very good job of exposing part of the power structure that influences U.S. policy in favor of Israel. I think they understated the degree to which pro-Israel policymakers within the government, people associated with the lobby in the past, people who have advised the Israeli government, were instrumental in shaping a U.S. Policy. I'm talking about people like Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, Abraham Shulsky, who were the architects of U.S. Iraq war, who falsified the data through their high Pentagon offices. I'm talking about Libby, Irving Libby, who was in the vice president's office. I'm talking about Elliot Abrams, who was the point man on Middle East policy in the National Security Council. These were people who were direct making policy. It was a former Canadian or a Canadian-American citizen from who actually wrote the Axis of Evil speech, and he's a fanatical Zionist, a co-author with Richard Perle, another fanatical Zionist of Bush's speech on the subject. So we're talking about high-placed members of the Bush administration with long-standing ties to Israel, and in the case of Douglas Feith and Elliot Abrams, fanatical in their defense of Jewish purity and opponents of any kind of assimilation into U.S. society. So these are individuals and collectively a group that Mearsheimer and Walt overlook in discussing it. The second thing they overlooked was the Jewish federations at the national, state, and local level who put Israel in the center of their activities. No leader, Jewish figure can become a leader of these organizations unless they pass the Israeli First Certification Program. And these are really grassroots organizations, and I think in many ways are as equal importance as AIPAC, the American-Israel Political Action Committee, which they focus on, which is important, particularly in Congress. But you also have to look at these local federations that also are extremely important in tagging local congressmen and getting into the media at the village, town, and city level.
Now, Mearsheimer and Wald, as distinct from you, are loyalists of the American Empire Project, but they find from that perspective as well that the influence of Israel and the Israeli lobby in the United States has undercut what would they see as more successful and realistic policies for empire. I'm wondering, when we come to the strategy for war building, permanent war making, on the part of the current U.S. administration, twice in Iraq, recently in Lebanon, pending in Iran, what would you say has been the role of what you call the Zionist configuration of power in both advocating and seeing that these war making projects are carried through?
Well, I think what you have to say is that what you, first of all, I agree 100% with what you point out. The perspective of Mersheimer and Wald is that tying U.S. policy to Israel hampers U.S. ties with right wing Arab regimes. It prejudices, antagonizes Europeans. Who are essential in U.S. multilateral operations, and it ties U.S. policy to a kind of colonial expansionism of Israel at the expense of the market expansionism which Washington favors in the post-colonial period, with occasional military interventions specifically aimed at regimes that balk at U.S. power, economic and political power. Now, in regard to shaping the U.S. agenda today, I point out in my forthcoming book that the rhetoric, particularly on the left, or center-left, or among liberal Democrats, that big oil is really the mover and shaker of U.S. policy is absolutely false. I've examined hundreds of documents, press releases, publications of the oil industry, and they were doing exceptionally well in the Middle East before the war. There's absolutely no evidence that they were pushing an aggressive militarist policy in the Middle East. This red herring was raised in order to avoid looking at the particular groups, particularly the Zionist groups, which were carrying on a massive campaign in the government, out of the government, in the newspaper, and in collaboration with the opinion pages of most of the biggest and most important dailies and television programs in the United States in favor of war. That is the key factor. It's not an ideological debate. It's an empirical fact, and I'm willing to debate that issue and bring loads of files and archives and printouts to anyone that wants to debate that issue. Secondly, they mentioned progressive people like Chomsky, the military-industrial complex. There's no question that the military-industrial complex benefits from a high military budget. However, and this is key, the military-industrial complex's biggest profits come from making arms which are not used in the Iraqi war. That is, high-tech airplanes and highly developed nuclear weapons which are not used in Iraq. And as a matter of fact, there's been complaints that there are inadequate labor-intensive weapons. How is this the case in a high military budget? The fact is, the military-industrial complex was not pressuring for a war; they were pressuring for a higher military budget, precisely in high-tech, high-profit projects. So to say that A, there's a high military budget, B, the military industrial complex benefits, is to overlook once again the empirical facts here, that the military industrial complex did not push for the war. They pushed for different kinds of arms spending which are irrelevant to the war. I once again need to say that the cliches by the liberal left on this war are all directly connected with their cowardice in facing up to their colleagues, their professional people, the media, the doctors, the dentists, who are active in their community pushing the Israeli line, which is that we must destroy Israel's enemies through our tax money, our fighting soldiers.
I wanted to ask you, in conclusion, what's the practical importance for anti-war and anti-empire organizing of having an accurate understanding of the operation of the pro-Israel lobby, whether in the United States or in Canada?
I think it's important because we talk about the war-making powers, we're talking about the war-making agenda, we talk about Harper, we talk about Bush, but we're not attacking the forces that are backing them, that are pushing them, that are providing them with the vocabulary of war. And so we're misdirecting our pressures, our adversaries, and therefore we're not able to neutralize them, to take on the media that is pro-Israel, the CBC or public radio in the United States. And I think this is why the movement is so weak, and the anti-war movement. And second of all, many of the peace people are intimidated by the left Zionists within these movements who censor the movements, don't let them raise the issue of Israel, let alone the lobby. And as a result, the movement doesn't have anybody to fight. If you're not going to fight the Zionist power structure on Mideast policy, and you're going to direct yourselves or misdirect yourselves, you're not capable of educating people in order to take or insert their politics in specific arenas, whether it's in parliament, whether it's in your local riding or whatever. I mean, the expatriate Ignatieff, who's rising rapidly in the Liberal Party, is a prime suspect who mouths all the cliches that comes out of the Jewish lobby and who says explicitly, I'm not going to lose a night's sleep over the savaging by Israel of Lebanon. Now, that's I'm glad he's left the United States, but I feel sorry for Canadians that have these kinds of potential political leaders.
Well, thank you very much, Jim, and we'll take up our responsibilities.
Okay, thank you very much for inviting me.
Bye-bye, Jim. I've been speaking with James Petras. His most recent book, The Power of Israel in the United States, will be available in early October.